Slavery in Dade County, the post-Civil War period, 1835 to 1895. At the beginning of the Second Seminole War, 1835 to 1842, the United States military abandoned Fort Bankhead on Key Biscayne. Instead, the Navy occupied a site on the south side of the pristine Miami River where it emptied into Biscayne Bay. A naval presence was deemed necessary to prevent the Indians from receiving weapons from nations hostile to the United States, such as Spain, or from Bahamian gunrunners. Before the fort was built, Indians brazenly canoed between the mouth of the river and the Everglades. The stockade constructed on the south side of the river was named Fort Dallas, after Commodore Alexander James Dallas, commander of U.S. naval forces in the West Indies. In 1838, the Army took over the small camp to launch its operations against the Seminoles in the Everglades. The Army moved it to the north side of the river near the present site of the James L. Knight Center in downtown Miami. There they cleared a wide area of hammock and built a blockhouse and stockade of pine logs. After the military vacated the site, it was purchased by Colonel Richard R. Fitzpatrick, a white farmer from South Carolina. In the 1820s, Fitzpatrick was one of the largest slaveholders in South Carolina. Beset by personal problems, he left his fortune and property to travel. When he arrived in Key West, he became an auctioneer, handling scavenged goods brought to him by wreckers. Blacks served the wreckers as divers, searching the sunken ships by diving for up to 2 minutes at a time, unaided by diving armor or compressed air, which were rare at the time. As Fitzpatrick recovered financially, he established plantations near present-day Fort Lauderdale and on his newly acquired property on the Miami River. He dreamed of being the first man to develop South Florida and was ruthless in his attempt to make slavery work on his South Florida plantations. Known for his extreme prejudice against blacks, Fitzpatrick wanted another Atlanta to flower on Biscayne Bay. When Fitzpatrick came to Dade County, the available workforce was made up primarily of Bahamian blacks. Of course, slavery had been abolished in the English-controlled islands decades earlier, and the Bahamians saw themselves as protected subjects of the British crown, as whites did. These independent-minded black Englishmen did not suit Fitzpatrick's need for laborers. He needed slaves. He solved his problem by purchasing 60 slaves from his sister, Harriet English, and bringing them from South Carolina to Biscayne Bay. He intended to grow sugar, cotton, and tobacco. With slave labor, he built a plantation that stretched from what is now the MacArthur Causeway to Mercy Hospital. Fitzpatrick and the other Florida slaveholders reacted to the Nat Turner Rebellion in 1831 by pressing the state legislature to restrict the growth of the free black population in Florida, hoping to escape the effects of their influence on their slaves. Fitzpatrick and his fellow planters were pleased when the state legislature passed a law in 1832 prohibiting the migration of free blacks into the state. The law made it illegal for, quote, any free Negro or mulatto to migrate or be brought into the territory from any state or territory within the United States or elsewhere, unquote. Fitzpatrick, serving as Justice of the Peace in Key West, interpreted the new law overzealously. His decisions were so extreme that Florida judges overturned at least three of his key rulings. In one instance, Fitzpatrick concluded that no evidence was needed that a free black person had been brought into the state illegally. He wrote, quote, "The court will observe that the law does not require any proof upon oath that a free Negro or mulatto has been brought here contrary to law. Any information of any kind is sufficient, or a citizen or officer can take hold of a free Negro or mulatto without a warrant and bring him before a magistrate," unquote. In another case, Fitzpatrick had convicted several blacks of entering Key West illegally when in fact they lived in Key West but had returned briefly to the Bahamas on business or personal matters. In Fitzpatrick's view, once a free black left Florida, he or she could not return. The reviewing judge released these blacks, saying, quote, "The legislature could not have intended to say that a free black person of color in traveling from New York to Louisiana should not pass upon the public roads of Florida, or if he did, should be taken up and confined in jail until it was convenient to the arresting officer to send him out of the territory. Nor could they have intended to say that a vessel passing on a voyage from New York to New Orleans with a crew of free colored persons on board shall not stop at Key West or St. Mark's to repair damages after a gale of wind without incurring the liability of having the whole crew seized and sent to jail there to remain until the sheriff thought proper to send them out of the territory," unquote. Seminole attacks forced Fitzpatrick to abandon his Miami River project. Like for Niels before him, Fitzpatrick had trouble getting all of his slaves to leave with him when they realized they could join the Seminoles and live in relative freedom in the South Florida swamps. Sending back to South Carolina those of his slaves who could be forced or persuaded to go, Fitzpatrick joined the fighting forces between the white settlers and the Seminoles with their black allies. Fitzpatrick traveled to Cuba and brought back bloodhounds to track Seminoles and blacks in the Everglades. This caused an outcry in northern newspapers, which viewed the use of dogs as inhumane. However, the dogs were not particularly successful being trained to track runaway slaves in Cuba rather than Indians and blacks in the Florida Everglades. After the war, Fitzpatrick tried to sue the government for damages to his plantation and for the use of his property as army quarters. In 1842, he finally gave up on the idea and sold the plantation to his nephew, William English, who also had a vision of creating a southern aristocracy on Biscayne Bay. From Charleston, English brought a schooner load of building supplies and a number of slaves, including some who were skilled in construction. He had his slaves clear the land and plant limes and lemons, which were still in wide demand for the treatment of scurvy aboard ships. The slaves built two stone houses using native lime rock. One was a two-story residence for English and his family. The other 97-foot-long, 17-foot-wide, single-story building was meant to serve as living quarters for his slaves. But before this building was completed, English heard about the discovery of gold in California in 1849. He sailed away with his family and slaves and never returned to South Florida. It is also likely that some of his slaves remained in South Florida living among the Indians. The military again occupied the Miami River site in 1855 at the outbreak of the third and last Seminole War. The army completed the buildings English had started, adding a piazza to the second-story residence. They used the slave quarters to house troops. The military again departed the site, this time in late 1858, leaving a rather comfortable dwelling which would later be purchased by Julia Tuttle, the woman who is recognized as the mother of Miami. The old slave quarters have now been moved from the Fort Dallas site to nearby Loomis Park, where the building is being restored. The post-Civil War period, blacks in Lemon City, 1865 to 1895. The American Civil War did not directly impact remote South Florida. The southernmost settlement in the area at the time was Lemon City, also called Motto, located about 4 miles north of what would later become Miami. Late in 1865, Colonel Thomas W. Osborne was appointed head of the Freedmen's Bureau in Florida. This Reconstruction-era federal bureaucracy was the arm of the national government responsible for matters relating to the newly freed slaves. Osborne sent out 5 teams to report on economic and social conditions of blacks in Florida. Only the report covering South Florida has been found. Colonel George C. Thompson was accompanied by William H. Gleason, a special agent of the Bureau, and they visited Hillsborough, Polk, Manatee, Monroe, Dade, Brevard, Orange, and Volusia counties. They conferred with civil and military leaders and concluded that blacks were faring well. In Dade County, they found only 3 blacks in need of Bureau assistance. At this time, Florida was still a frontier state and South Florida virtually an untouched wilderness. During the Reconstruction era, the Freedmen's Bureau devised a plan to relocate 50,000 former slaves to Dade County, which included all or most of what is now Broward, Palm Beach, and Collier counties. The plan was killed by Gleason, who returned to Dade County as a carpetbagger with his own plans for the area. Broadly speaking, carpetbaggers were Northerners who were appointed to civil positions in the South following the Civil War. The name refers to the bags made of materials similar to carpeting, in which they carried their belongings en route from the North. Carpetbaggers were generally resented by white Southerners, including those in Dade County. Carpetbaggers were seen by Southern whites as nigger lovers who would have black people rule whites in the defeated South. Gleason did nothing to discourage this impression of carpetbaggers in Dade County. Indeed, he encouraged it by his own actions. Gleason became a legend in South Florida in his ruthless grab for power. Notably, he associated with 2 freed slaves, Andrew Price and Octavius Amar, who had settled in Lemon City after the war. After Gleason managed to become lieutenant governor in 1868, he arranged to have Amar appointed school board chairman and Price appointed as county commissioner and a member of the Dade County School Board. Price is believed to have been illiterate. According to the late Miami historian Thelma Peters, Amar was a mulatto from Sullivan's Island, South Carolina, and Peters believes that Price was the first black person to hold public office in Dade County. The carpetbagger appointments were made before there was any organized government in Dade County, probably as a political ploy for Gleason rather than as a serious attempt to empower blacks. A significant number of the early Lemon City pioneers, black and white, came from South Carolina. The black pioneers of Lemon City often lived as squatters in shacks in the citrus groves being cultivated by white farmers. According to Peters, quote, many black families did not live in communities but were scattered, sometimes living on farms or groves belonging to white growers where they were assured of a house to live in and at least seasonal work. House was a shack, some better than others, for which rent was usually $1 a week and paid for by work, unquote. By 1890, there were also a few black farmhands from the Bahamas living permanently in Lemon City. Florida's main drawback, in addition to its isolation, was that there was no promise of commercial development. For Lemon City pioneers and other white settlers in South Florida in the mid-19th century, the dank wilderness offered no commercial opportunity except to dig for kumquat, a wild plant of the Syed family which grew abundantly on the floor of the pine woods. Kumquat root could be boiled, converted into starch, and taken by boat to Key West for sale. The root was edible, and it became a food staple for many settlers, white and black. Peters reports that in early Dade County, every man, woman, and child, white or black, dug for kumquat. In 1910, Lemon City's Hearst family opened a starch mill, creating a large and steady demand for the roots, which were eventually harvested to extension in South Florida. The most common task of laboring blacks was digging kumquat and clearing land, called grubbing. However, blacks also found work in the lumber industry, which flourished because most structures of the day were built of the strong pine that thrived in the area. Knight's Sawmill was located near the bay at Lemon City and operated from 1894 to 1906. A number of blacks worked there and lived nearby on Sawmill Road, later to become Northeast 62nd Street and now called Martin Luther King Boulevard. Quote, grubbing was the hand clearing of the pine woods, usually after the larger trees have been timbered off, the removal of the vegetation and the breakup of the surface rock by means of a short-handled, heavy, deep-bladed grub hoe with the help of an axe. The tough, fibrous palmetto roots so penetrated the walls and crevices of the limestone as to resist toughly any assault by man. Grubbing was back-breaking work, yet before bulldozers and some of the earlier mechanical devices that preceded them, it was the only way the land could be cleared. Grubbing was assigned and paid for by the task, which was an area 40 feet by 40 feet. Clearing a task also included piling up roots and brush for later burning and making a rick of the rocks. A task was sometimes a full day's work, and the pay was from $1 to $1.50 per task. The Tropical Sun, on September 13, 1894, reported that black labor in Lemon City was usually paid $1 a day. As work gangs swung their picks and axes and hoes, they reveal their African heritage, synchronizing their movements to a chant led by a gang leader. Some say Peter, huh. Some say Paul, huh. But the God above, huh, is Lord of all, huh. The blow of the sledgehammer or hoe came on the huh. Black Pioneers of Coconut Grove, 1880s. The black community of Coconut Grove was established in the early 1880s. The Coconut Grove settlement, like Lemon City, was well established in 1896 when Miami was born. A white man named Charles Peacock hired two black Bahamians to work as laborers in his Bayview house, later to be called the Peacock Inn. In the days before Miami, this was the only hotel between Lake Worth and Key West. The Coconut Grove community grew up around the Peacock Inn, which was built in 1882 on a gentle slope of rock overlooking the bay in the direction of the Cape Florida Lighthouse. Today, this is the site of the city's Peacock Park on South Bayshore Drive. The first Bahamian to come to work in the inn was Mariah Brown. She actually lived on the hotel premises. Later, a small Bahamian-style home was built for her on the ridge behind the hotel. This building still stands on Charles Avenue, near the Coconut Grove Playhouse, and is the oldest black dwelling in Dade County. In the late 1880s, more black Bahamians arrived, primarily to work at the inn and as laborers on farms in the area. They built a small settlement near the Brown House along Evangelist Street, now called Charles Avenue. This tiny, distinctly Bahamian settlement was at first called Kibo. The first black person born in Dade County, Irene Gertrude Sampson, was born in Coconut Grove on November 20, 1896. Her father, the Reverend Samuel A. Sampson, formed the first black church in the area in 1894. When she died on June 19, 1996, she was the last person known by historians to have lived in South Florida in the 19th century. The Oddfellows Hall on Evangelist Street was built in 1897. It was the home of the black organization for which it was named and was the center of social life in the early Black Grove. It was then a two-story building. Meetings were held upstairs, and the downstairs was rented for dances and other activities. Among the social clubs to frequent the hall were the Household of Ruth and the Patriarchs. This historic building, now only one story tall, still stands at 3288 Charles Avenue next to the Mariah Brown Home. The structure now houses the United Christian Church of Christ of Coconut Grove. Bahamians played a key role in South Florida's transformation from a wilderness into rich farmland, demonstrating to skeptical whites that the agricultural practices of the islands could be successfully introduced to South Florida despite the abundance of coral rock. George Merrick, who later founded Coral Gables, noted that the Bahamians changed the early white settlers' viewpoints regarding the feasibility of growing crops in this rocky country. White settlers saw the land as forbidding and desolate from a planting standpoint. But Merrick wrote, quote, "In the Bahamas, there is the same coral rock, and the Bahamians knew how to plant on it and how to use it, and they knew, too, that all kinds of tropical trees would grow and thrive on this rock. They, too, had a vital influence upon our civilization in bringing in their own commonly used trees, vegetables, and fruits," unquote. Merrick also acknowledged that the way in which South Florida buildings were constructed was also influenced by Bahamian blacks, some of whom were skilled as masons. Quote, "They knew how to make a lime mortar from rock and how to use it in building rock houses and walls," unquote. The most prominent black family in Coconut Grove was the Stirrup family. This Bahamian family dynasty was established in the United States by Ebenezer Woodbury Franklin Stirrup, who was born on Governor's Island in the Bahamas in 1873. Ebenezer was a mulatto and an illegitimate child. His mother had been a servant in the wealthy white Stirrup household, his father's family. Ebenezer's mother sent him to school as regularly as she could. Nonetheless, he grew up essentially uneducated. In 1882, when he was 9 years old, his mother died. Ebenezer was taken in by relatives who felt sorry for him but apparently worked him mercilessly. According to his daughter, Louise Stirrup Davis, quote, "He was expected to scale fish and sell them too. This being the situation, he could only go to school selectively," unquote. Determined to get out of the country, Stirrup saved his money and in the late 1880s, at the age of 15, left the Bahamas. He immigrated to Key West, where he worked with his uncle as a carpenter apprentice for 10 years. In 1894, at the age of 21, he returned to the Bahamas to marry his childhood sweetheart, Charlotte Jane Sawyer, also 21. They had 10 children, six of whom reached adulthood. While in Key West, Stirrup became disenchanted. His daughter, Kate Stirrup Dean, recalls that her father resented giving part of his earnings to his elders, so he picked up and moved again, this time to Cutler in South Dade County. Cutler was a settlement 14 miles south of the mouth of the Miami River. Here, Stirrup worked as a pineapple cutter during the day. At night, he cleared land. Sometimes he was paid with land instead of money, and he invested much of the money he did earn in land. In 1899, at the age of 25, Stirrup moved again, this time to Coconut Grove. Over the years, he worked as a chauffeur at the Deering Estate at Vizcaya and worked on the farm, which was part of the estate. He continued to speculate in real estate and gradually was able to accumulate considerable wealth. He constructed a large home for his family at the head of Charles Avenue. It became the most impressive black home in the Grove and still stands today, owned by Stirrup's descendants. Kate Stirrup Dean recalls that their house did not have running water during her early childhood. There was no freshwater system in Coconut Grove at that time. Instead, most families used windmills, usually shipped from Chicago, to provide fresh water. When white pioneer Joseph Froe decided to sell some of his Coconut Grove land, Stirrup wasted no time in buying up a number of lots. Stirrup built small Bahamian-style rental homes from the plentiful and sturdy pine trees which blanketed the South Florida area. Stirrup and his wife constructed these rental houses themselves, usually working at night after a full day's work. In addition to helping him with the labor, Charlotte, employed as a laundress, would hold a lamp by which her husband could work. Many of the stirrup houses still stand in Coconut Grove. He rented these houses principally to other immigrants from the Bahamas, giving many of the new arrivals an opportunity to save enough money to buy their own homes eventually. Through these holdings, the Stirrups became one of the wealthiest families, black or white, in Coconut Grove. The Bahamian-style cemetery in the Black Grove on Charles Avenue at Douglas Road is called the Charlotte Jane Memorial Cemetery after Mrs. Stirrup. The tombs stood above ground in the burial style used often in the Bahamas. According to Louis Stirrup Davis, the Stirrups owned the land but sold it by lots. Stirrup set aside 14 lots for his wife and family members because Mrs. Stirrup did not want to be dug up after her death to make room for more bodies, a common practice in those days. At one time or another, EWF Uncle Abe Stirrup owned much of the land that today comprises the Coconut Grove downtown area. He also owned property along what is now Flagler Street. During the Great Depression of the 1930s, however, Stirrup lost much of the land as the Biscayne Bank failed. Despite this setback, and despite having sold Henry Flagler the right-of-way when the railroad came through, Stirrup still owned 317 parcels of land in Coconut Grove when he died in 1957 at age 84. Rebecca Gibson Johnson was not yet 2 years old in April of 1904 when she arrived in Coconut Grove from the Bahamas. Her family had come to the Grove after a brief stay in Key West. She recalled, quote, "We lived behind the Stirrups' old home in a house on their property. The Stirrups were living in the house they had before they built the big house. My mother and Mrs. Stirrup were first cousins. They were good friends when they were growing up. Our families are very close. The whole family used to call Mr. Stirrup Uncle Abe. He was nice with all the kids, but he was very stern. He had a horse named Snifton. That horse could run real fast. He had a chestnut color. Uncle Abe had a one-seat buggy, and he would go into Miami on it. He would take orders from everybody and bring back the orders from Miami." Unquote. Johnson's memories of her childhood in Coconut Grove in the first two decades of this century provide rare insight into the beauty of the area before it was developed. She also offers a poignant picture of social life in the black Coconut Grove community at that time. Quote, "It was a beautiful ride into Miami. The road didn't run the way it does now with Bayshore Drive running into Miami Avenue. It used to follow the water line. It went down until it met up with the road where Mercy Hospital is now. At that time, Miami Avenue followed the water line. It was beautiful. It went right through the hammocks. There were lots of birds. The Florida Panther was in there, too. That was something to scare the boots off everyone. Mr. Stirrup used to sit on his porch with his legs crossed and just look at everybody go by. He used to say everybody was his brother or sister. He would wave at everybody. Anything that happened overnight was told to him. He didn't have to go anywhere to hear what was going on. White and black people came. His wife was his secretary. He was a loan master. He owned houses and rented them out." Unquote. Another pioneer Black Grove family, the Smiths, arrived from the Bahamas in 1916. According to Lorena Smith, daughter of family patriarch Asa Smith, the crossing from the Bahamas was slow, hot, and agonizing. Lorena, then 8 years old, was traveling alone to meet her father, who had arrived earlier that year from Grand Bahama Island. The boat was becalmed for several days within sight of the Miami coastline. In the heat of the day, the motionless ocean looked like a solid thing to Lorena, as if she could walk on it. At night, the face of the sea was like a black mirror staring up at her. From the deck of the sailboat, she and other passengers could see the lights of Miami twinkling on the horizon, but no wind would come to deliver them. Finally, on the afternoon of the seventh day at sea, a gentle breeze filled the sails, and the sleek little sloop sliced its way into a sparkling Biscayne Bay. Lorena's father, Asa, was born in the Bahamas on June 8, 1873. His wife, Eliza Parker Smith, also Bahamian, was born on June 6, 1874. Asa had come first to South Florida early in 1916 to clear land. Like many other Bahamian men, he sent for his family later. By October 1916, his wife and three children had joined him. The family lived in a small black settlement called Ricetown, which was located at what is now Northwest 8th Street and 22nd Avenue. The area was named after a white family. On the advice of George Merrick, the white founder of Coral Gables, Asa Smith purchased two lots in the area now called Golden Gate near George Washington Carver Elementary School and the family moved into the Grove in 1925. Grand Avenue and Douglas Road were merely sandy wagon wheel ruts at the time. Several black-owned businesses flourished along Evangelist Street in the early 1920s. At that time, the black business section of Coconut Grove stretched from Hibiscus Street to Main Highway, where the Ritz and Mayfair shopping complex stands today. The blacks called it Sugar Hill. Among the black businesses located there were an ice cream parlor, a bakery, a grocery store, and a dry goods store. Rebecca Gibson Johnson's description of life in the Grove is revealing. There was a man named Vincent Albury. He used to have a meat market down on Charles Avenue. Mr. Vincent would go into Miami. He'd sometimes come back telling us these weird stories that would make us feel the Florida Panther was near. He would say that he heard the Panther and that he heard women screaming for help near the Punch Bowl, a freshwater spring along the shoreline near present-day Vizcaya. People always believed that pirates had buried gold near the Punch Bowl. In 1908, the Coconut Grove Playhouse had a big wall around it. There was a bicycle store on the other corner. Black boys would all rent bicycles from the shop. The boys would ride and see the girls who were working as waitresses at Camp Biscayne, a white tourist resort. That's the way they would get acquainted. There were bicycles everywhere, all the way into Miami. There was another shop down the road there. It belonged to Joe Major. He was one of my father's cousins. Getting around on bicycles was the livelihood of all the black boys and girls. All of them rented their bicycles for work from Joe Major's shop, except on Blue Monday, when nobody worked. On Blue Monday, everybody went to the courthouse, where Liberty City is now, to watch who was getting thrown into jail. I remember people would not think about working on Monday because it was called Freedom Day. All the boys would rent bicycles and ride into Miami. Folks went to church on Sunday. After church, you were not allowed to do anything like what is done now on Sundays. You didn't play basketball and all that. That was unheard of when I was a child. They didn't have a Liberty City when I was growing up. Liberty City wasn't even heard of, unquote. In the early 1900s, to get to Miami from Coconut Grove, one took the path along the shoreline, which had been cut through the hammocks and dense woods to connect Coconut Grove and the dusty, bustling town rising at the mouth of the Miami River. According to Lorena Smith, people crossed the river into Miami in the early 1900s at a place called Tuttle Point. On the other side of the river, it was called Brickell Bridge Point. On each side, a large conch shell was blown to call the barge to take people to the other side. The cost was 10 cents to cross the river one way. Asa Smith walked the path to Miami and beyond for many years. Lorena Smith recalls that in the early 1920s, when her father worked to clear land in Broward County, his work day began at 4 in the morning. He would leave the house to walk nearly to Fort Lauderdale. After crossing the Miami River before the break of dawn, he trudged north, sometimes in an early morning rain, following the swath cut through the woods for the railroad. At the end of the workday, he walked back to Coconut Grove. Early white settlers on Biscayne Bay, 1870 to 1894. By the 1870s, a white family was living 6 miles south of Lemon City near Biscayne Bay. This was the William Wagner family, possibly the first white family living permanently in what would become Miami. Wagner had accompanied the army to Fort Dallas in 1855 to supply food for the troops, but it remained after the army left. He settled on a tract of land a mile upstream from the mouth of the Miami River. William Brickell and his family arrived from Ohio in 1871. He opened an Indian trading post on the south side of the Miami River at the bay. Trading with the Indians primarily for pelts, egret plumes, and alligator skins in exchange for weapons, ammunition, clothing, utensils, and tools, the Brickell Trading Post became the area's most successful business. Brickell owned about 3,000 acres of prime bayfront land stretching for 3 miles south of the Miami River to where Mercy Hospital stands today, just north of Coconut Grove. His holdings included the famous bluff of White Rock along South Bayshore Drive. After the Civil War, a group of Georgians acquired the English property, formerly Fort Dallas. They founded the Biscayne Bay Company, intending to produce bananas on a 640-acre farm on the north side of the river on the present site of downtown Miami. This effort failed since the soil was too poor to produce a marketable product. In 1874, one of the main shareholders in the Biscayne Bay Company, a man named Joseph H. Day of Augusta, Georgia, sent his nephew, E.W. Ewan, a proper Charlestonian, to South Florida to see whether the enterprise could be saved. Farming was a limited enterprise in South Florida in those early days. Without a railroad, it was difficult to get fresh fruits and vegetables out of Dade County to northern markets. Ewan reestablished the Biscayne Bay Company in the long two-story stone house that had been built by William English's slaves. He lived in the main building on the property, now much improved by the army. Indeed, the sturdy edifice would become the temporary home for many of the white pioneer families as they arrived on the shores of the bay, and in 1874, it would become the Dade County Courthouse. The county seat was later moved to Juneau. By the end of the 1870s, fewer than 50 white people lived in the area that would become Miami. Julia Tuttle first came to South Florida in 1875, traveling with her father, Ephraim T. Sturdivant of Cleveland, Ohio. Sturdivant, an iron industrialist, had accompanied William Brickell to the Biscayne Bay area to build a winter home in a little settlement called Biscayne, 8 miles north of the Miami River, near present-day Miami shores. On that first visit, Julia Tuttle was struck with the splendid beauty of the place. She soon dreamed of a city in the South Florida wilderness and returned to Biscayne Bay several times between 1875 and 1886 with her husband, who suffered from tuberculosis and needed a warmer climate. Unfortunately, the discovery of South Florida warmth came too late for him. He died of the disease in 1886. Julia Tuttle began buying up land on the Miami River as early as 1888, fearing that her children had inherited a predisposition to tuberculosis and wanted them to grow up in a warm place. She compared the climates of Florida and California, and in 1891 chose Florida as her permanent home. For $2,000, she bought out the Biscayne Bay Company, owners of the Fort Dallas property, and evicted Ewan. She moved into Fort Dallas on November 13, 1891. At the close of the 1880s, life moved slowly for the handful of white and black pioneers who lived in the South Florida wilderness. This was soon to change. The Great Freeze of 1894-95 was the catalyst. Julia Tuttle was the visionary, and Henry Morrison Flagler was the means. Flagler had been a partner of John David Rockefeller in the founding of the Standard Oil Company in Ohio. He became one of the richest men in the country. In the early 1890s, he sold his interest in oil and shifted his attention and considerable money to railroads. This change in Flagler's life and fortune came as a result of his wife's failing health and the imperative to move her from Ohio to a warmer and cleaner climate. Like Tuttle, he chose Florida. Flagler first visited Florida in 1878 on a trip undertaken for his wife's health. They came only as far as Jacksonville. Having also discovered Florida too late, Flagler's wife died in 1881. Flagler remarried in June of 1883 and spent the winter in Jacksonville and St. Augustine. During this visit, he decided to establish himself in Florida and to launch a new career in railroads and hotels. Flagler opened the extravagant Ponce de Leon Hotel in 1883 in St. Augustine. He improved existing rail lines to that city and by 1888 had extended rail service to Daytona. In 1893, Flagler secured a charter to build his own rail line through the untouched lower east coast of the state. With Flagler's Florida East Coast Railroad providing the life-giving impetus for the state's growth, he almost single-handedly developed the state of Florida. New communities flourished along the railroad tracks. The railroad brought tourists from the north to languish in the warm climate and pamper themselves in the grandiose hotels that Flagler built. The railroad also enabled the state to bloom as the nation's winter vegetable garden. Blacks served as a primary labor source in Florida for planting, tending, and harvesting the crops that rode Flagler's rails. They also provided much of the labor to build the railroad and operate the hotels. By November 1894, the Flagler line had reached West Palm Beach, which at that time was an unincorporated community of about 1,000 people. Flagler established several hotels in and near Palm Beach, including the Roy Ponciana on Lake Worth, which could accommodate 1,200 guests and had a dining room that could seat 1,600 people. It was one of the largest wooden structures of its kind in the country. He also built the Breakers Hotel. Finally, Flagler built his magnificent private residence, a great mansion in Palm Beach called Whitehall. Since most of the common laborers in Flagler's land clearing and building empire were black, Flagler was the major factor in the expansion of the black as well as the white population in Florida at the turn of the century. However, the growth that the railroad brought to the north and central parts of the state stopped short of Biscayne Bay. In the winter of 1894, Flagler settled in at Whitehall with no immediate plans to go farther south. But 3 days after Christmas that year, the hand of God moved, and Julia Tuttle's dream became reality. The Great Freeze of 1894-1895. A devastating freeze in the winter of 1894-1895 nearly wiped out the agricultural industry in the southeastern United States. For many years, the general public remembered it simply as the Year of the Ruin, but it eventually became known as the Great Freeze. Actually, it was not one, but two bone-chilling and extended cold spells hitting the South in December of 1894 and again in February of 1895. Ironically, only hours before the first freeze struck, one of Jacksonville's newspapers, the Daily Florida Citizen, carried an article about the expected bumper crop in citrus. According to the article, oranges, above average in quality, bright, juicy, and selling at a good price. Citrus growers were hopeful and encouraged, believing that more oranges would be shipped out during that season than in any previous season in the state's embryonic orange-growing history. But on Friday, December 28, 1894, farmers in Florida and across the South waited anxiously as an unprecedented freeze engulfed their vegetable crops. Another Jacksonville paper, the Florida Times-Union, described what happened in North Florida. Quote, a northeastern blizzard, which found its center in Pennsylvania, swept the East Coast, and a northwestern blizzard swept down from the Dakotas, coursed with equal violence upon our west and Gulf Coast, uniting or joining forces with an increased power, enveloped the entire peninsula with the chilling breath of the Ice King. Of our bountiful and beautiful orange groves, pineapple plantations, and vegetable farms, nothing escaped. The people, the land upon which they live, with their scorched and withered, and in many cases dead orange trees, alone remain, unquote. The next day, Floridians awakened to record-breaking low temperatures. In Jacksonville, the Weather Bureau's official thermometer registered 14 degrees, 1 degree lower than the temperature registered during the severe freeze of 1886, and the lowest reading in the Bureau's history. Almost every interest in the state was affected by the freeze. Business in Florida was at a standstill. Railroad and steamship lines suffered. Trees and other vegetation looked scorched. Fruits and vegetables were covered with ice, in many cases frozen solid. In North Florida, fish were frozen in the bay. Poor people particularly were vulnerable. Farmers were especially hard hit, as many lost their entire income and were left destitute. The Florida citrus industry suffered particularly. When the freeze hit, half of the season's crop, approximately 2.5 million boxes of oranges, was still in the trees, and few escaped irreversible damage. Within a matter of hours, one of Florida's most promising industries was nearly ruined. By that Monday, the cold wave was practically over. Temperatures had remained below freezing for 40 hours. The calamity caused by the freeze left many Florida farmers discouraged and gloomy. Others were somewhat more optimistic. Most agreed, however, that the orange trees were safe. A majority of farmers replanted, as they would have done had there not been a freeze. They anticipated the next crop to be ready for market in March and were hopeful that things would soon return to normal. But the worst was yet to come. The greatest crop injury results when an early winter freeze is followed by a period of warm weather sufficient to initiate new growth, and this in turn is followed by a second freeze the same winter. This is what occurred in the winter of 1894-1895. January's weather was mild. Trees put out vigorous new shoots, and growers felt that they had come through the experience in good shape. But the trees, thus rendered especially vulnerable, were killed to the ground by a second freeze in early February 1895. This freeze was believed more severe than that of December. Cattle and sheep suffered. Some starved, and others froze to death. The entire vegetable crop froze. Again, the loss was tremendous. Florida property worth $75 million was destroyed by the second freeze. The extent of damage to the budding citrus industry can be seen from these crop figures from the Florida Fruit Exchange. 1892-93, 5,055,367 boxes. 1894-1895, 2,500,000 boxes. 1895-96, 150,000 boxes. According to Helen Parse DeLand, whose father founded DeLand, quote, "The trees that were painstakingly restored to life were bushy, never regaining the old symmetry," unquote. The citrus industry appeared dead. Indeed, a revival of the industry was not apparent until the 1900-1901 season, and prosperity in the industry did not reappear until the 1908-1909 season. Among the white families displaced by the freeze were the DeRoches, who lived near Jacksonville. Estelle DeRoche Zumwalt was 7 years old when the first freeze struck in December. She recalled in her memoirs, quote, "That night, the thermometer dropped to 19 degrees, and a pan of milk on our screen pantry froze like ice cream. But the tragedy of it was that the Bering Grove father had recently bought had frozen too. The oranges were balls of ice, and in a few days they were black and rotting on the ground under the naked trees. Father began to think about moving farther south." As countless white farmers were ruined by the freeze, so too were many blacks who owned farms and thousands more black farm workers who helped plant, tend, and harvest southern crops. Many of the freeze victims, white and black, packed their belongings and moved south, some eventually coming as far as South Dade County. Shivering from the coldest weather most of them had ever seen, many were settled permanently in South Florida. End of chapter 1.